So here's the thing I wanted to disclose to you straight up. I may be the only person of our general age range that has not seen Mad Max.
Oh my goodness.
To the Exploring Washington State podcast. Here's your host, Scott Cowan.
So I am with Dee today at Mad Max Cars. And so Dee, I want you to tell our audience, well, Mad Max Cars kind of gives it away, but why don't you share with us what it is you guys are doing here and how you guys got started in this?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's kind of a fun story. So Mad Max Cars in general is a movie and TV replica car builder. So in for those who are not into that particular hobby, what we do is we build show quality replicas of the cars you've seen in movie and films, typically hero cars. So like that, I mean, Kit from Knight Rider, the General Lee from Dukes of Hazzard, Eleanor from Gone in 60 Seconds, although we don't actually do that one because there's some legal issues there. But that's an example of what I'm talking about.
Okay.
You know, those sort of things, the Starsky and Hutch, what they call the Striped Tomato, their Gran Torino that they drive, or, you know, the 67 Mustang from Bullet, or Greased Lightning, or the DeLorean Time Machine from Back to the Future, or the Ecto-1 from Ghostbusters, or, of course, our signature build, which is the Mad Max's Pursuit Special or Interceptor, kind of interchangeably, depending on where you're at in fandom. The black-on-black car that he drove in Mad Max 1, Mad Max 2, and then briefly in Mad Max Fury Road, the more recent one. So those are the kind of vehicles we build. We also build parts for cars so that other people can build their own replicas. So we supply parts. And we've also been importing Australian muscle cars since the late 90s, which is kind of how we got our start. I can go into that story. That would be kind of the next thing.
Yeah. So when we talked on the phone and, you know, you said you imported Australian muscle cars, I was like, I didn't know there was muscle cars from Australia. I'm not a big car guy. So here's the thing I wanted to disclose to you straight up. I may be the only person of our general age range that has not seen Mad Max.
Oh my goodness.
Ever.
Okay.
So yeah. when you're talking about the show, and so full disclosure, less than 5 minutes ago, a guy was here in the shop where we're at, and he was walking by and saw your car out front.
Right.
And so he rang the doorbell and he gave us a tour of the workspace and all that. And you guys are talking in code, you know, and I was kind of laughing because I'm going, I have no clue. I mean, I know what the cars look like because I've seen, you know, you can't have lived in America with a television set and not seen some little snippet of Mad Max.
Right.
But so, you know, but I've never watched the movie.
Well, don't feel too bad. You're not the only person I've ever met. I would say it's few and far between.
Yeah.
But considering the, you know, the genre that I work in the car hobby, you know, you could easily say that I'm probably not going to be as often exposed to people who don't know about it.
Right. And so for me, this is fun because I don't really know. Like your car you were sharing is the, you know, one of the bad guys' car. And then,
right.
Okay. So I'm like, oh, okay, cool. You could have lied to me and said that was Max's car. And I would have, oh, okay. So, but what I do want to unpack here. So when we started talking, you said you guys started importing Australian muscle cars.
Right.
And I once again said, I didn't know Australia had a muscle car culture.
They do. Yeah.
So what? Yeah. How did this come about?
Well, you know, I have not really deeply studied the entire Australian automotive culture. But, you know, going back to the 50s, I'm pretty familiar with a lot of their cars just because I have mates that are from Australia and live in Australia.
Okay.
You know, by the nature of what we do with the Australian cars, I've been exposed to quite a bit of Australian gearhead culture, if you want to call it that. So, obviously they've been making automobiles, you know, nearly as long, if not longer than America has, you know.
Really?
They go back to that same time period, you know. Automotive technology kind of developed in most of the industrial age countries roughly the same time. And there's a little bit of argument who invented the first one. I'm not going to get into that here because I'm not super knowledgeable in that area. But But yeah, roughly around the same time, within 10, 20 years, everybody was making internal combustion and or electric cars, which were actually a lot more prevalent in the early years of the automobile than they are even now, as far as percentage wise. Well, maybe we're starting to rival it finally, but
okay.
And each country, I'm sure engineers and enthusiasts of automobiles shared information across and technology across, but in the sense of aesthetic, everybody's car culture developed a little bit separately, how and they got used and what their what developments were made, and those things got shared across. But basically what happened in Australia was they were building some of their own cars, I believe, in the early days, but mostly they had other American car companies and, you know, English car companies producing cars with factories in Australia.
Okay.
The muscle car era specifically, they had Holden, which is GM down there, General Motors. It's kind of like a Chevrolet equivalent almost, although most of the cars there were unique going way back. Mm-hmm. They have Chrysler down there. And I'm sure they had CKD, or what they call complete knockdown cars, early on, which is where cars are shipped in pieces in a crate, or, you know, partly disassembled, and they get assembled in the country. So it starts that way. Then eventually, they, when they have enough demand for cars, you know, they start building their own, okay, which are usually based on, at least in the case of Ford, were based upon American designs. The Ford Falcon in particular is kind of was their central main vehicle that they built. So as that went on, you know, the Chrysler had muscle cars. They had a cool Charger that you won't see anywhere in America that looks unique. It has, they even developed a 6-cylinder Hemi engine that they had in their Chargers. The Holden had the Monaro, which has kind of some vague similarities to a Camaro. You know, sort of maybe a Camaro crossed with a Nova or something like that. They're cool cars.
Okay.
Hopefully I'm not offending any Aussies or any other gearheads out there by making that analogy. But for people who've never seen a Monaro, they're a cool car that looks like an American muscle car in the aesthetic and design. You can kind of see the influence of that muscle car culture, which is shared in America and Australia and almost nowhere else in the world as far as the manufacture. You know, so all of these manufacturers are down there, and particular to what we do, the Ford factory down there, Ford was selling, the Falcon was their most popular vehicle down in Australia. So when America stopped making Falcons, in the late 60s, early 70s, basically, mm-hmm, they left Ford Australia with no mark to sell. That was their most valuable asset down there. So they started designing their own. And hence we have the Falcons that were used in the Mad Max movies, were basically that first generation of the unique Ford in Australia.
So those were like early 70s cars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So you guys started importing those cars.
Yes.
And when you started importing them, were you doing these conversions, or were you just being an automotive importer of interesting Australian cars to Washington and, you know, the United States?
So, yeah. So when it started, essentially we were started by a gentleman named Terry, who lived in Texas, and he was importing the cars. He wanted to import one for himself. That's kind of how almost everybody's story starts here. Yeah. They were influenced by Mad Max. Most of America's fascination with Australian muscle cars can be traced to Mad Max crossing over. And we'll get into that, I'm sure, later. But
yeah.
But so this gentleman named Terry wanted a car, and so he started working on importing one and met a young gentleman who was a teenager at the time over there, who scouted and found him a quality car and helped him get it exported over here to America. And some of his friends heard that this was going on, and it spread a little bit. And eventually he kind of started a little website and started importing these cars, not doing any conversions, just importing Australian muscle cars, primarily the Falcons. That got popular enough that he needed some help doing it. And it made more sense to have somebody like on one of the coasts near like a port. To get them to Texas, they have to come into a port and then go overland a little ways to get to where he was, generally, because these imports, usually they come in mostly on the West Coast, but sometimes on the East Coast into the ports on the coast there.
Sure.
So my now business partner, Troy, was doing something very similar to what I was doing and looking on the internet and found you know, found this guy who was importing Australian Ford Falcons and contacted him. And through a short association, it made sense for him to be the guy here in the Seattle-Tacoma area that was working on getting the cars in from the port, getting them ready to ship out and arranging overland transport to people. So he partnered with Terry. And that's right around when I met Troy. I think he'd been working with Terry for maybe a year at most when I came along looking for a car myself. So I came to Mad Max Cars as a client. And that's kind of how all that happened. And
you liked it so much that you bought the company, that old Victor Kiam Razor thing. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Basically, that was it. Yeah, I came looking for a car. I bought a car. And the joke that I perpetuate around the shop is they haven't been able to get rid of me since.
Okay.
Troy eventually asked me to be a partner. But at the time I came and joined the company, one of the customers we were importing a car for asked, well, will you build a replica for me? So it started as an importer strictly. Then we moved into making replicas, and that's a whole story in itself there.
Okay.
Which I mean, I could go on.
I think we're going to go there, but so. All right. So when you guys, how do I want to ask this question? So when you started importing these cars, are they fairly common in Australia? Are they becoming more difficult to find? I mean, they're 70s era cars. Time is not kind to automobiles. So
absolutely.
Are these kind of becoming garage finds now or barn finds? Or are these like, if I looked outside here where we're at today, I'm going to see 100 Toyota Camrys in about a 3-minute window. Are they? They're not that common, right?
No, absolutely not. So Australia is interesting. There's some differences from the way American manufacturing works. Part of it is that there's a lot lower population there per capita. So they didn't make nearly as many cars of any given year or model or whatever than you'd see in America.
Right.
So. These Australian Falcons, if you count the sedans and the utes, which is kind of like a Ranchero or an El Camino, a little half truck, they call them utility or a ute down there. So if you count the sedans, the utes, the station wagons, and they have a thing called a panel van, which is, we'd call it a sedan delivery probably.
Okay.
But it's basically like, if you took an El Camino and put a big camper shell on it, except it was all part of the body.
Okay.
So that's what they call vans down there. They don't really have the box vans exactly the way we do. And then these, what we call the coupe or the hard top, which is the one the Mad Max car is based on. If you took all of those, they probably made, 250,000-300,000 in a given year. You know,
still a lot of cars.
Yeah, exactly. Still a lot of cars. But just like in America, there's what I kind of call the Barrett Jackson effect, my cleverly coined term, which it's my way of in shorthand describing the fact that nowadays there's no real middle ground of cars. You know, with any classic car, especially desirable ones, the ones that are available, that window is getting narrower and narrower. The prices are getting higher and higher. Well, that's going on. When I was a kid, or even just 20 years ago, you could find a car that was not too difficult to restore. There was some middle ground. Nowadays, any classic car, almost, you've got the wide ends of that spectrum. You've got cars that have been restored, mm-hmm. and cars that are survivors that have been maybe always garaged and are still, really nice, even though they haven't ever been restored. Then there's nothing in the middle till you get down to the cars that everybody's passed over the last 20, 30 years as being too difficult to restore. That's the pool of cars that's left to be restored these days.
Okay.
So that middle ground, that's where the term barn find comes in. My opinion is the reason why that's such a popular term is because that basically translates to car that really needs restoration but isn't going to be nearly as difficult as one that's been sitting in a field for 30 years, or 40 or 50 or what have you. So
yeah.
That barn find car is the one that's really filthy maybe, but a lot less work to restore. But that term's gotten so popular now that people won't even wash the dirt off of a car they find in a barn because that makes it more valuable, in the short term, But anyway, so yeah, suffice to say that it's the same story everywhere in the world. So in Australia, these classics are getting harder and harder to find.
Okay.
We can still find them easily, but it basically means that they cost more and more money is what that boils down to. And your choices for a replica build are going to be either you're going to spend a lot of money on them, to restore them, or are you going to spend a lot of money to buy them and then tear them down and basically redo everything? So it's kind of a toss of the dice. Even ones that have been restored haven't always been restored very well, and they might look beautiful, but Bondo sculpture is an art form that's taken over the world. So, you know, and people do nasty tricks like put metal shavings into the Bondo so that you have a little magnetic meter that can sometimes tell you how thick Bondo is. Well, if you put metal shavings in the Bondo, like we found sometimes on some of these restored, quote unquote, cars, you know, that it'll fool you. You know, you can tap on it and hear the thickness maybe. But anyway, yeah, I guess that's a long winded way of saying that they're harder to get. They're more expensive. And lately they've become a lot more popular. They were kind of not the most popular muscle car in Australia up until about 10, 12 years ago. So the prices have gone up, not only because they're rarer and harder to get, but also that they've really, there's a car culture that's developed around them that really appreciate them in Australia deeply now, a lot more than before. There was always a good Australian car culture based on those cars, but now there's a lot more people that appreciate them for what they are. So they get snapped up real quick. So it's a chore, and it's more money to find them, but they're still there.
So then you guys started, guy asked you if you'd make a car for him. And so you guys started this process of making Mad Max cars.
Absolutely.
How much, I know this is an impossible question to ask or answer. I can ask it easy. Answering it's gonna be tough. How long does it take you to build one of those cars?
So,
I mean, you know, depending on what you're starting with, is the huge variable.
Yeah, both cost and time to build one varies quite a bit, and it's based on a number of things. Cost starts with how much did you spend on the car your base car that you're building from, and then timeline kicks in from there, and is affected by all the same things, which is how rough is the car? You know, how much restoration does it need to be a viable car to build from? And then what all does the client want? You know, do they want it to be something you can park over a mirror at a car show, or is it going to be something you're going to drive every day? Are you going to take it to the racetrack or drive it on the streets of your town and on the highway sometimes, or all of the above?
Right.
How expensive of a paint job do you want? You know, that's not only how much you're spending, but how much time somebody is sanding to make it perfect.
So the one that's on the floor, about how long did that one take?
Well, so that one's not not the best example, because it's a car that it has some of our parts on it, but it was actually built by someone else and came here to have upgrades.
Okay.
It belonged to the Volo Museum in Chicago, and one of our good clients bought it from them and brought it to us to correct some stuff that wasn't movie accurate, build a new motor for it, put a new transmission in it, rear end, upgrade the brakes.
Okay. So that wasn't completely.
But to answer your question as directly as I can, on an average timeline, 2 years is probably about an average.
2 years.
Yep. And I know if you are somebody who's watched shows like, Fast and Loud, Gas Monkey Garage, or any of these other shows on TV, they might make you think you could restore a car in a week. A paint job doesn't even dry in a week. You need to be able to let it dry, sand it, paint it again. You know, if you're going to do a car right, it'll take you well over a week just to paint it. You know,
wow. I had no idea. Yeah. Cause I've watched a few of those shows, you know, and you're right. They, you know, they, in 30 minutes, they can take a bucket of bolts and turn it into something that looks pretty darn cool.
And that might have been filmed over the course of a week or a month, but you know, they put these timelines into the dialogue. We've been on reality TV a few times, and I can tell you it's nothing real about it. The work we did was real, but the whole story and timeline surrounding it was all Hollywood manufacture.
So what was the first car? What was the first car you guys made?
So the first car we made was it was a 75, I think, XB GT. It's the only car we've ever built out of a real GT. I know there's a ton of people cringing because GTs are these extremely rare cars. There's only like, I think it's 926 XB GTs made over the course of 4 years.
Okay.
So rarer than a Shelby. Rarer than, you know, maybe not quite as rare as a Hemi Cuda convertible, but, you know, close.
Close. Okay.
It was a GT that we imported. The guy specifically wanted to use a GT because it was important to him that the VIN number was a JG66, which is, you know, for those who are uninformed, that's the prefix of the VIN number that says this was an XBGT coupe.
Wow.
Right.
Okay.
So anyway, so, that's kind of beside the point, but no, we don't encourage people using a GT. Nowadays, you'd probably have to spend an extra $60,000 or $80,000 and throw that down the tubes because you're taking away everything that makes it a unique car as a GT. Anyway, so he had asked us to import this car, and while it was on the ship over, he said, "Would you guys consider building the replica for me, a Mad Max replica?" And we thought about it. At that point, I was just becoming a new partner in the business. And we talked about it and decided that we both had a ton of experience restoring other old Fords going back to high school. You know, so we were, you know, well-versed in the art of automotive repair and restoration, and that these cars were pretty similar. You know, we had found two Mustangs of the similar vintage or Torinos in the chassis and whatnot. They literally are on a Mustang Comet. Montego Torino chassis. So we said, yeah, we'll do it. And, it was a client who lives out in Chicago, really awesome guy. He's a cop out in Chicago. I think he's actually a gang unit cop, possibly, if I remember correctly. Anyway, so we're building this car for him. We ordered at the time what was the best quality fiberglass Mad Max kit on the market, according to everybody that we talked to. We brought that in and it didn't fit the car at all. It was like bent down on one side. The nose cone was bent down like an inch and a half on one side and up like 2 inches on the other side. It didn't fit the car very well. It was really poorly made piece of fiberglass. And my business partner, Troy, he comes from the aircraft industry where if anything is more than, a thousandth of an inch or two out of perfection, then it's garbage. So he spent a while trying to get this piece of fiberglass to fit and literally in a fit of frustration threw it over the back fence of the old shop that we were at into the Brambles where I bet it still is today down in Sumner. And he called the client up and said, look, I can make these parts fit your car by cutting them up and reshaping them a little bit, but it'll never be right if you can be patient with me. Which meant like probably a year or more of be patient before I can even start building. Mm-hmm. I will build new tooling and make new parts that fit the car right.
Okay.
And the guy said, well, I want it to be right. Yes, do that. And so that started not only building the replicas, but also building the parts that other people can use as well as we use to build these cars. And my part of that was I did a lot of research and helped get companies that were either defunct or didn't make an old vintage part anymore to make them again so that we could put them on the car or recreating stuff ourselves, that kind of stuff. So, and that's kind of how it happened. It was, you know, way back in 2000, we built the car for this guy and it set us on the road to building a bunch more.
What was your background before you got into this business? So what did you bring to the table besides the fact that you wouldn't leave the table? As you said earlier, you wouldn't leave.
Well, a ton of backyard mechanicking and shade tree mechanic skills.
Okay.
My auto shop teacher was a guy by the name of Al Young, who was a drag race champion.
Okay.
When I was in high school, he was a NHRA and AHRA Superstock champion at the time.
Okay.
And had been champion several years in a row, and he was a really badass drag racer. I can say that, right?
Yeah, you can say that. Very good.
So I had a decent education to go on and background and my own experience in restoring cars, but my background was music, mostly music and sound engineer, but I also as a day job worked in the photographic sign and reprographic industry. So
okay.
Recreating graphics for the vehicle. Okay. And
so you brought some other, I'll say softer skills to the equation.
If you want to say that, but yeah, I also design. Been in the entertainment industry. So customer service and answering emails and doing the phone calls and dealing with vendors.
Right.
So
the people skills versus,
versus the people skills,
the wrench.
Yeah.
And no disrespect to the guys that are wrenching.
We couldn't do it without them. Right, we have an amazing staff and that's, I wouldn't have anything to do if it weren't for them. And they tell me vice versa. So
yeah.
I think we've got a good hybrid going on, but you know, I throw down on the wrench too. Like for example, we get a Australian Falcon in to tear down to build a Max car. I've torn apart so many of them now that it's second nature to grab some tools and start tearing them apart. So I throw down when I can, but yeah.
So 20 years ago, you guys started building the replicas, approximately. Yes. So let's flash forward to today. How many people are working here?
11.
You have 11 people.
Yep.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah. Plus Troy and myself. So
there's 13 people. You have 11 employees?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And that's
awesome.
Yeah. It's not just because of Mad Max cars. You know, we also employ those same skills to restore antiques and classics and muscle cars now. So plus we build every movie car that there is as well.
Right. So I'm going to put you on the spot, and this is where you're going to agree to let me drive that Roadrunner home. Since this is an audio medium, at the time of recording this, is that a 69?
69 Roadrunner. Yeah.
It's just, trust me, it's gorgeous. Anyway, I digress. So let's talk the other movie cars. I'm going to put you on the spot. Of all the cars you guys make as a replicas, mm-hmm. What's your favorite?
My favorite?
Your personal favorite.
Oh, my goodness. It's probably the one that I drive.
Okay. Tell us about that.
I mean, there's several that kind of tie as second tier, but I ended up building the car that was probably my ultimate favorite. And that was the Red XA Bat is what people call it, or Red XA Wipeout. I don't think it was named in the script. There's very few cars that were named in the Mad Max script. But in Mad Max 2, for those of you who are familiar with the film, Envision, its most prominent scene was in the final chase. So this is a red car. It's built out of an XA Falcon. So it's really similar to the Mad Max Interceptor. The general body shape is the same. But it's a red car with a black roof. It's got a big tail fin on the back that's taller than the roof. It's got side pipes on it, just like Mad Max's car, the four on each side pipes, except they're almost as tall as the roof. It's got eight tubes coming out of the hood that are basically like a Hillborn injection unit. It's not actually a Hillborn injection unit. I'll get into that later if need be. But so that's sticking through the hood. It's got a big bat painted on the hood. It's got this huge air dam out in front, like a big cow catcher wedge with floodlights on it. The ordinary headlights have been deleted by these black plates. Really, really super mean looking car. But if you're familiar with the movie, in the final chase scene with the tanker, they pull up next to the tanker. They pull the warrior woman's dead body that's hanging on the barbed wire on the side off and throw it under the wheels of the tanker truck. The passenger is while the other guy's driving. And then they come up and they're coming up to Max where the door's been ripped off the tanker and he's driving it with no door. And he literally gets out on the step with his shotgun and gives them both barrels through the windshield into the driver's face, who then obviously loses control because he's dead. The guy in the passenger seat's trying to drive it. It gets all out of control and squirrely, gets in front of the tanker, and the tanker rams through and it like disintegrates as the tanker barrels through it, basically. And, you know, goes off to the side. And it bounces down the embankment or whatever. So that car was the one. It was kind of an accident. I'll be honest. I always loved that car in the movie. But when I contacted Mad Max Cars, this is really how did I get to be Mad Max Cars also ties in so tightly with that car that I kind of have to circle back to that a little bit. But obviously, I fell in love with the Mad Max movies when I was a kid. And I can go into that in more detail. But getting back to the car, I looked up Mad Max cars once the internet came out. I found out what kind of car it was when I was younger. But when the internet started to get popular enough that, you know, they had it at work. So first thing I ever typed into the internet was Mad Max car.
No way.
It was. The very first thing I ever searched for on a search engine was Mad Max. And I found that there was a website, madmaxmovies.com, which is still there. Huge, great source of information if you're a Mad Max fan. And found a bunch of people there who on a chat board who were like-minded fans. And it opened up this world of, man, I'm not the only nutcase who loves Mad Max. There's millions of other people in the world. What do you know? Leave it to the internet. And I stumbled across these guys, Mad Max Cars, through that because there was a thing that talked about who the different vendors were. I went to their website. Didn't have enough money to buy a car right then, but it got me thinking about buying one from Australia. So once I got a little money saved up, I called them again found out they were here, here in kind of the Seattle Tacoma metro area, called up, and the guy said, "Oh yeah, we have a few here for sale right now." Troy, who's now my business partner, and I'm looking into the phone going, "Okay, I know where that is. That's about 45 minutes away." I put the phone back to my ear. "I'll be there in half an hour." So I roar down there and literally at that point make a deal to buy a car. And, you know, the rest is history. My thought was it was an XA that I bought because it was the most solid car, was the best car for the money. And I knew that you could change the front sheet metal and build a Mad Max car out of it. So I bought that one as my donor car. But no sooner had I got it home than I'm looking at it and doing a little research. And I realized the XA Falcons are more rare than the XB. They're pretty unique. And I'm starting to love the design of it more than the regular XB as far as just a stock version of the car. And so I'm starting to say to myself, what do I do? You know, what do I do with this car? I don't really want to knock it in the head and turn it into an XB, but then I can't have my Interceptor. And then all of a sudden it clicked. That red car in the movie, that's an XA. And every time I see it get smashed, I'm like, no. Oh, dang it. I would have taken that car. You know, so we started building that as a replica and debuted it at this event called Road and War Northwest. The very first one we put on was where it debuted in 2007 was when we had it finished. So
you've had that almost 14 years now.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazingly. Time flies, huh?
Yeah. Time flies. So I just to put into context, we're meeting here today at Mad Max Cars and I was early from another appointment and I was sitting in my car and full disclosure, I drive a fully restored Honda Pilot.
Cool.
Yeah. Everybody wants a Honda Pilot. Anyway, no. And you pull up and I'm just like, what the heck? And you're driving this car. And so it was very cool that completely out of the blue to me, you show up in this car. And so it's the fact that you're driving it, I think is awesome. Because one thing about cars, I love to see them on the road. I love to see them being used. Uh-huh. You know, yes, it's cool to see a, you know, whatever, insert name, a pristine car, but it's also cool to like see the car on the road.
They are meant to be driven. I love car museums, but the ones where the cars actually get driven and are primarily most of them drivable, those are the ones I love to see the most.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. So we started with the Mad Max cars. What was the next movie car that you guys – what was the first non-Mad Max car you built a replica of?
So the first non-Mad Max replica we built was – well, first of all, we started delving into the villain cars first.
Okay.
With my Red XA Bat, we've built a replica of the Lord Humongous Machine, which is in the second movie. It's a one seater weird, you know, six wheeled mean looking. It was a truck, but it's anyway. If you've seen the movie, it's the thing that Lord Humongous drives. It's this crazy, totally customized thing. We built that. We built the pink 58 DeSoto, and so those kind of things were sort of like our first getting outside of it. Mm-hmm. By the time we were doing that, though, we'd already been restoring some stock vehicles for people because we had the facilities and the know-how.
Right.
And quite honestly, you know, we may be one of very few people who are building Mad Max replicas, but it's still a very niche hobby, even in the movie car industry. So we realized early on if it was going to be any kind of a business more than a hobby that we'd need to expand a little bit. And I don't think any of us ever started in this with the thought we were going to make a business out of it. It was all because we wanted a car for ourselves or, you know, loved the hobby. But once we started expanding out of that, we started we built a Greased Lightning, I think probably would be the very first non-Mad Max replica that we built. And for those who are familiar with the movie Grease, it's the dream sequence one that's got the clear plexiglass hood and the red paint job with the white lightning bolts and the giant rear fins and the Palomino dashboard and all of that stuff like he describes in the song, basically based upon the song, you know, Greased Lightning. So we built that, you know, but we've done quite a bit of other stuff. You know, we're working on restoring a screen used Knight Rider car right now.
Oh,
so.
Really?
Yeah. So, and that's interesting. It's not actually from the 1982 through 86 series. It was used in the pilot movie for the 2008 reboot.
Okay.
Where the Mustang was the primary hero car, but in the in the pilot movie, they have a 82 style Trans Am all done up like Knight Rider, but it's taken apart with parts hanging from the ceiling and a tarp over part of it, and it's all disassembled and whatnot. And that car got acquired by somebody, and you know, they wanted to go ahead and restore it into a Knight Rider replica.
So that's, you guys are working on that now.
Yeah, we're working on that. We're doing a very, for those of you who are sticklers about screen use cars, we're being very curatorial about it. We're preserving every little bit of provenance we can, while taking it from what's barely more than a glorified stunt car as far as condition and completeness, and putting all these parts that were hanging off from the ceiling near it into the car, keeping as much as we could to the originality of the screen used car, while also making it a legitimate Knight Rider, complete kit.
Okay.
But yeah, we'll do the generally from Dukes of Hazzard. We'll do Starsky and Hutch's Gran Torino. I mean, all those ones I listed at the beginning, those right. are all ones that we would do.
So
we'd do Chitty Chitty Bang Bang or Herbie the Love Bug if somebody wanted us to.
I was wondering if you'd do the truck from Beverly Hillbillies.
Oh, sure. Yeah. 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 That one actually would be a really fun build. I've met George Barris, and I've actually done a little studying of that car, so I know what it would take, at least.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. If somebody asked me to build that, I would know where to start. So, I'd still have a lot of research to do. But.
So let me ask you this. I put you on the spot. What your favorite car is. What right now, as of today, what would be the – if you could build any car that you want – what would you want to build?
Oh, goodness. I like some really obscure cars. If I was gonna add another car to like my collection or have my choice of customer walks into the door and wants you to build X, it'd be a toss-up between a few things. I'd love to see us build a Corvette Summer Corvette. Those are one that's if you don't know it, it's a Mark Hamill movie that he made right around the time he made Star Wars.
Yeah, I remember it vaguely.
But. Yeah, the crazy-looking custom Corvette that it's one of those love-it-or-hate-it ones.
Okay.
Corvette purists probably think it's a piece of dog do,
right.
you know. But people who are movie car crazies or love custom cars or, you know, can forgive somebody for molesting a Corvette in that way, then it's an amazingly cool car. So it'd be that. There's a movie called The Wraith. It's a Charlie Sheen movie. It's a crazy 80s movie.
Okay.
The car they used in that is actually a prototype Chrysler vehicle called the M4S. It was a mid-engine four-cylinder sports car that they built in conjunction with PPG, which is a paint company that
right.
they built to do racing and pace car work and stuff like that to test out the mid-engine platform, basically, and build their own kind of supercar was kind of the idea. So they built this one car, and it got used in this Charlie Sheen movie called The Wraith, where he was like this spirit back from the dead that kind of manifested as a car or as this kid on a motorcycle and went and killed the guys who killed him, basically.
Okay.
But really cool car. So, or the other one, probably another big one would be the Black Beauty from Green Hornet. That would probably be one that I really love to see a replica of.
Okay. Now this is totally, these are all American cars you're saying, but how about, I mean, there are new Bond movies out. I always love the Bond movies to see what they're driving because the Bond cars are kind of cool. Do you guys do any of the British cars?
We haven't yet, okay. But we have a couple guys on our staff that are very familiar with them from owning their own and restoring their own.
Yeah.
I would love to do that. You know, if I was to have a pick of the Bond cars, I'm tempted to say the Lotus from The Spy Who Loved Me, but I really like the DB5 from Goldfinger the best.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's Batmobile level with all the gadgets that it has. You know, the bulletproof thing, the ejection seat, the guns that pop out of it, the changing license plate.
Yeah.
You know, all of that stuff. So, yeah, the Goldfinger DB5, that would probably be my Bond car.
That'd be fun.
That I would pick. All right. Yeah. Although, you know, the Vanquish that he drove in, oh, it's one of the newer movies. I can't remember what movie it was in, but a buddy of mine has a Vanquish just like that. One of our clients, actually, who's got several Falcons we imported for him. He has a Vanquish also. That's just a beautiful car.
So I, like I've said a couple times, I'm not a car guy, and I'm just chuckling as you rattle off all of these. You know, I say the Bond car, and you're giving me specific, and I'm like, well, okay, I forgot there was a, oh yeah, that was a Lotus. You know, and I just think the Bond car, you know, mm-hmm. I just, anyway, so I laugh at that. But as we're bouncing around, this is the part of the show where we just bounce around in Scott's brain. I'm looking behind you as a poster of a DeLorean time machine.
Oh yeah, I love that one. That's one of my favorite movie cars of all time.
So, what on earth did you guys have to do when you make a replica DeLorean time machine? What all gets added to that thing?
Oh, that's actually a really, really long involved subject.
Oh,
So. It's not super kind to the DeLoreans. I mean, it's pretty much reversible. I mean, other than you tend to have to drill quite a few screw holes if you want to do it right, mm-hmm. like the movie did, into the stainless steel panels.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's wires and there's everything inside the car, all of the control panels and stuff. That's all custom built, hand built stuff that, you know, prop shops built. So there's a lot of really good guys out there who build the props. One thing that's good for us, that gives us some versatility, is we try not to reinvent the wheel. We're pretty stickler on our quality of stuff. So if there's a vendor out there who builds parts that are to our level of quality, why take business away from them? We'll buy the parts that meet our quality standards and not have to re-engineer and rebuild some of these things. We do a lot of the parts for the Mad Max cars, almost all of that in-house. But
maybe a DeLorean.
Like the DeLorean time machine, there's tons of people who make every part on there. You know, so there's a handful of guys who make them to the standards that we would like to see. But you got to put a flux capacitor in there, which – I mean, you've got to fabricate a box and put a little window in it, and you have to have a label maker to make the right labels, and you have to, the flashing lights are, you know, like a chase light that you have to get the right kind, and there's every little piece there, you know, there's little standoffs that the lights are on. You know, if you know what the right pieces are, you have to search down all the right little trinkets to put even that box that's like, you know, it's smaller than a bread box. You know, just to build that involves hours and hours of finding the right pieces and putting it together. But, you know, and then the on the back, where he puts the plutonium in, and then Mr. Fusion is on there later. Mr. Fusion is a super rare, now super expensive, because of the movie, Krupp's coffee grinder. You know, so they put this coffee grinder and they put a little label on it that says Mr. Fusion, yeah. Which you have to recreate the label. You have to get this coffee grinder that's now several hundred dollars to buy one on eBay because of the movie. and then the thing underneath it was like a piece of computer hardware from the late 60s, early 70s that there's only a handful of in the world. I think they used a real one on the original car. But almost all of the other cars in the movies and all the replicas have like a fiberglass casting of one. You know, a bunch of the pipes and the weird little parts and giant resistor looking pieces and stuff back there are things that they got off of an aircraft junkyard. There's pieces of military helicopter stuff on there, and there's old airplane stuff on there. And it's just this conglomeration of stuff that, when they built it, the prop guys went out to the prop stores and bought stuff out of their junk bins and went to the aircraft junkyard and bought stuff off of old planes and helicopters and cobbled it together, you know, to look like the drawing they were given. Now, guys who are building replicas
have to follow that exactly.
You have to not only follow that exactly, or, you know, make replicas of these parts that are now super rare, hard to find, and expensive.
Right.
But, you know, it's even with the Mad Max cars to a lesser degree, because there's a lot less pieces and parts, but those movies were made so long ago that something that you might find in junk shop, you know, or fairly easily then, now it's you know, really difficult to find stuff. So, 30, 40, 50 years later, depending on what movie you're replicating, the little bits and pieces that were someone found as a like I said, picked up at a junk shop or at a swap meet or whatever, right. or whatever. They're now difficult to find these pieces. And fortunately, there's on like the DeLorean time machine, there's guys who've studied every single piece of it. So, you know, if we had to go back and recreate it from scratch, it would be very, very difficult.
Now, something you said before we were recording, just to kind of give context to what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. The guy, I don't know who that guy was. So somebody knocked on the door. You was admiring your car. You let him in. We got a quick tour of the place, and you were talking to him.
Right.
And when we were coming back in, you offhandedly said you've watched Mad Max frame by frame.
Oh, yeah.
For maybe 7-12 times. I can't remember the number, but it was more than once.
Yeah.
And so you guys are studying these movies frame by frame to ensure that, you know, what you're looking, because I mean, as it flies by at 60 frames a second or whatever it is, you know, I think it's about, you know, probably, you're breaking that thing down into 60. I mean, that's crazy attention to detail.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I guess I've looked at every frame of the movie. If there's not a car in it, I've probably gone through pretty quick. When I say I've watched it frame by frame, I think maybe the complete movie once frame by frame.
That's crazy.
But the bulk of the movie multiple times, any scene there's a car in, I've watched frame by frame. Any scene where he's holding a, like if Mel Gibson is holding a prop, like a pair of binoculars, or when he's eating out of the dog food can or whatever. Yeah, I've watched all of those parts frame by frame because, you know, we're always interested in the props. And sometimes when we're building a car, someone says, well, can you put these props in there? You know, anything that relates to it. So there's a lot of work to study it. Yeah, I mean, I've literally watched the movie hundreds of times just because I enjoy watching it. But when you get to studying for the movie, we not only watch it frame by frame, but we also go through and do screen grabs frame by frame and make a build book. The Mad Max Interceptor, now we've done it enough times, we don't really have to refer to it anymore. But when we started, and any car that we're doing for the first time, or, you know, if we've only done it once or twice, there's a folder full of screen captures of every little detail that gets a close up and wide shots of the car. And, you know, every frame, not every frame it appears in, but, you know, if there's like a 20 second segment and you get two or three good angles of the car, then out of a 20 second segment, we might end up with three images that capture different things.
Okay.
You know, and we look for the best one, the least blurry, you know, because cars are moving. There's bound to be one where you can see the parts you want to see. So we make these build books, and we add to that behind the scenes photos if we can get it. And we'll also even go to the effort of contacting people who built the cars or were involved, like the transportation director and, you know, the picture car coordinator and stuff
like
that.
Are they cooperative as a rule? I mean,
not as a rule, no, but most of the time they're glad to talk about, you know, they're glad to talk about it. If you're not a crazy fan bugging them, like irritating them,
right?
You know, most of these guys they're not afraid to talk about these things. Their desire to talk about some of this cool stuff, they don't have a chance to that much, you know.
Okay. So
somebody like us who's got a legitimate reason but's also kind of a whack job fan, you know, it's fun for them to talk about it and go into detail with somebody who understands the technicalities of the stuff that they did, you know.
So let's talk about the fans, because in passing conversation or reading on you guys have thrown some events, right?
We put on some, and we also go to others that aren't put on by us.
Okay.
So we got involved in doing fan events. The first one we put on was in 2007. We put on the first Road War Northwest. So Road War Northwest was based on a series of events that have been being done by a gentleman named Carl Bartoszynski. And he is also really well known. He does MadMaxCostumes.com. So he's a famous costumer. He sells his own clothing. I encourage you to look him up if you like post-apocalyptic wear and gear, Mad Max themed costume items or any of that kind of stuff. He also makes other cool clothing, but he's a good guy to search out. He was instrumental in starting Wasteland Weekend, which I'll talk about in a second. But before he did that, he did an event called, I think his was Road War 101, which was named after the Highway 101 that they did the event on. And it consisted of a group of cars getting together that are kind of Mad Max themed replicas and stuff. Another element is like celebrity guest. Viewing the movies is another element. And the biggest element, the coolest one that was part of this whole Road War USA thing, was the movie replica cars. They'd hire a guy driving a tanker truck, and they would emulate the tanker chase at the end of the movie in Mad Max 2 on a highway somewhere in America, usually going from where they had their car show and ending it where they're going to watch the movie. So there'd been several of these one-off events, and a lot of fun stories included in there, including 12 guys known as the Texas 12 now who got arrested for doing this event because they got a whole bunch of complaints to the police that there was a armed militant people attacking a gas tanker. So yeah, they threw him in jail, but fortunately they got out the next day. It was a hassle, but anyway, so we put on this event. We called it Road War Northwest because we didn't want it tied to the specific highway. But in 2007, we did it at a local museum called the LeMay Family Collection now. The LeMay family also has another museum called America's Car Museum, but that came along later.
Right.
Anyway, so they invited us to host the car show portion of our event at their annual car show, which has been going on now for – then it was, I think, in its – like 37th or 38th year or something like that. Anyway, it's over 40 now, but they invited us to come out to their museum and have our event there. So we had Mad Max cars. We also had a handful of other movie cars. So even from the first year, it was Road War Northwest and the Star Car Concourse Classic. So, and which basically is to say that all movie cars are welcome at this event,
right?
Basically. And we do judging based on the American Movie Car Association judging rules and stuff and all of that.
Wait. There's an association for movie cars and with rules for judging.
Yes.
See, I'm so out of my element. This topic is not, it's fascinating, but it's not, I'm not knowledgeable at all. So wow, there's rules. Okay, cool. Go on. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I interrupt. Go.
That's another thing I'd be glad to go into at some point. But
oh my
yeah.
gosh.
So when we started this event, we decided to have a 3-day event because people were coming from all over the country to come to this and even some from Canada. So it was international. It's the International Movie and TV Vehicle Owners Association is the club that kind of is now the caretaker of this event. So
anyway, so
we had this in 2007. Incidentally, we planned to build the XA Bat, which is my car. We started building it about 7 months before the event. So it was a crash course in build that car for the event. And it was premiered there. The first day we had an evening event with a concert, like a rock concert with a band called the Blacktop Demons, which kind of Mad Max themed. Rockabilly blues rock band, and a costume contest with everybody dressed up in costume. Costumes, again, they're an integral part usually of most Mad Max themed events. So we did that the night before. The day of, we had the car show from, I think it was like 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. with the car show that, and not only was the Mad Max car there and the Interceptor and the Red XA Bat, but Kit from Knight Rider was there. There was a General Lee there. There was a Flintstone Mobile there. There was, there was a bunch of cars there and a bunch of what now is called like wasteland themed or post-apocalyptic themed cars, which are look like cars from the Mad Max films, but are like creations of the owner.
Sure.
You know, you could throw them into a Mad Max movie and they'd be a perfect place, but they're not a replica of anything you'd see on screen.
Right.
So it was this mix of cars. So we had the car show till 5. At 5, we left the car show, drove to a now gone drive-in movie theater that was called the Valley 6. It was like 6 drive-ins in one down in Auburn, a town near here. Sad it's gone, but cool place. We went there. And Vernon Wells, the guy who plays Wes in Mad Max 2, he also played Bennett in Commando. He's a great character actor from Australia, was there as our special guest. So he rode along in the Interceptor. He signed autographs at the show and gave away Mad Max merchandise. Then we went to the movies and he actually did an announcement over the speaker system before Mad Max 2 introducing it. So we're watching the films and turns out the lady that I talked to who booked the films managed to get the Australian print of both Mad Max 1 and Mad Max 2. There's some differences. So everyone sitting there watching it who was in the know was like, these are the Australian versions of the movie. Awesome. So we did that. And then there was like a goodbye breakfast the following day. So, and we've put this event on every year since 2007, both Road War Northwest and the Star Car Concourse Classic. So now we've been done a 1 day event since the first year, but every but since then, a bunch of other events have popped up, but we're the longest running Mad Max themed event in the world, annual Mad Max themed event in the world, and the longest running multi-genre movie and TV car event in the world.
So when do you normally, what month is this normally
it's
held?
It's almost always the last Saturday of August. In fact, other than this most recent year, other than 21, it's been the last Saturday of August every year.
Okay.
And up until 2020, it was at the LeMay Museum every year, but they were closed for COVID. Mm-hmm. You know, we did a social distanced version of the event both this year and last year. But we did it anyway because we wanted to keep the consistency of the annual event.
So do you think moving forward, you'll go once normalcy, that's an interesting word to say, but normalcy is restored. Do you think once social distancing is no longer needed, you'll go back to LeMay, or will you guys?
That's a tough call because we've had really amazing success having it here at the shop in this parking lot. This year, in fact, we broke it into two. If you want to check out our YouTube channel, there's videos of almost every year on there. But okay. We broke it into two events this year. In early June, we had a car show. And the car show not only had movie and TV cars, but like LeMay, they have a ton of other cars because it's their annual show as well. But we put on a big car show here because we have a ton of non-movie car clients and friends. Okay. And there's a whole cruising scene that's developing because of COVID.
Okay.
So it was an enormous event. It was so big that this whole parking lot, all four buildings around every single parking spot and in front of a bunch of the roll-up doors. And I mean, the whole parking lot, literally, we couldn't fit any more cars in here.
Wow.
We had to turn cars away for a couple hours. And once a few people started leaving, we started telling people, okay, come on in. There's probably a space. If you don't find one, just cruise around, enjoy the show. If you find a spot, great, park.
Okay.
But anyway, so that part one was this massive car show. And we had movie and TV cars there, all the ones in the shop, plus a bunch of others. And the Wasteland cars came up.
Okay.
So we had that. And then in September, early September, we did a cruise. So we got all of the Mad Max themed cars together and a couple of the other movie cars that were available. And we went out and joined. There's a town near here called Enumclaw.
Yep.
that has a Friday night cruise once a month. In fact, this is happening all over the country, that the whole cruising is popping back up. So we went out there and joined their Friday night cruise and brought the movie cars out and kind of did a mobile road war thing that day. So other than that, it's been a 1 day event. But so it's going to be tough. Next year it'll be tough. If COVID's gone away, it'll be a tough call whether we're going to go back to LeMay, have an event here, or do both.
Or do both.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the people at LeMay have come to expect to see the movie cars, for sure. We've become an amenity that a lot of the people that come there like to see. So.
Okay. So we could go on and on and on about what you guys are doing, but to keep our episodes kind of where they need to be time-wise, this is the part where we transition and go, so when you're not doing what it is you do, in this case, cars, what do you do for – what's entertainment for you? Tell us a little bit more about you. What are you doing? I'm sitting next to your...
My 14-year-old wolf? Yeah.
Who's asleep next to me?
Yeah. I'm married to an amazing woman who supported me through everything. We've been married quite a few years now. We met back in 2000. So she was actually by my side as the whole Mad Max thing just started to develop and has supported me through all this craziness.
Is she a Mad Max fan?
Yes and no, not as nutty as I am. She does enjoy cool cars and that kind of thing, but no, she doesn't go off the deep end.
Watching it frame by frame.
No.
Okay.
No, but once in a while, she's more than willing to throw on a cool post-apocalyptic costume and join the fun at Road War Northwest or whatever.
Okay.
She's been super supportive, but yeah, so I'd say that's probably the most important thing in my life is family, which means my wife and my dogs.
Okay.
So we have two dogs. We have a 14-year-old gray wolf or timber wolf. She's black, but if you type into Google black timber wolf, you'll see pictures of animals that look just like her. She's a really sweet dog for being a wolf. And we also have a 3-year-old mastiff. And he is he's about twice her size, both in weight and dimension. Anyway, so we have those dogs. So I love spending time with my dogs and my wife. I'm a collector of stuff. I collect records. I have a couple of cars of my own. Obviously, that's going back into this hobby. But I collect movie memorabilia, music memorabilia.
So what genre of music?
Heavy metal, mostly.
Heavy metal?
Heavy metal, hard rock.
Okay.
But I delve into some other stuff, punk. I like a little bit of everything. You know, I like everything from opera and classical to super hardcore punk and thrash metal and black metal and stuff.
Because you were in a band before.
I've been in several bands. So that was what I was going to transition to is one of the other things that I spend a lot of time doing has been the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
I've owned and operated a 16-track analog recording studio since the late 80s. Well, I guess the 16-track came along in the mid-90s, but
okay.
I've been recording since the 80s. Been doing live sound and reinforcement since the 80s. Been playing in a band that The Rocket, which was a magazine that used to be popular.
Oh my gosh, The Rocket.
Yeah, The Rocket was basically the Seattle's music newspaper for years and years. They called my band RIP. What did they say? They said the biggest and most important cult movement in local music, I think is what they said, or something very much to that effect.
Okay. So was that the band that was referenced in Rusted and Brian Nairn's and James Beach's book, Rusted Metal?
It was.
And yeah. I'm skipping two of the other authors. Sorry, guys. I can't remember your names. But there's four contributors to that book. So I know two.
Yes. Amazing guys. All four of them are really cool, amazing guys. That book is amazing. If you're a music enthusiast and want to know about Northwest rock and metal, there's another podcast that you can find right here on this channel that's amazing about the book. The book itself is amazing. I'd pick it up. They're
labeled. Heavy. It's too heavy to pick up, man.
Yeah,
it's 900 pages long.
It's like if you're as old as I am, it's about equivalent to the white pages in Seattle.
Yeah, or an old Sears catalog.
Sears catalog.
It's a massive tome.
Yeah, it's a massive tome. There's about a 7-page article on us in there.
Okay.
Their record label does a ton of good music. But
So RIP, you guys are back together?
Kinda? Yeah, so we formed in 87, and we played regularly with lots of lineup changes. I'll let you read the book for the history. but played what was kind of our last gig before we went on a lengthy hiatus in 95. So 87 to 95, not quite 10 years, I guess. And then in 2013, we got back together. To great success. So we're still playing. Unfortunately, we did have our lead guitar player passed away in a motorcycle wreck just recently. So we are working on putting together a tribute record in his honor, which was going to be the record we were recording with him with all of our new material. But we're going to do it as a tribute record now. But
what instrument do you play?
I'm the singer.
You're the singer of the band. Okay.
Yeah. I play rhythm guitar a little bit.
Okay.
But we have a rhythm guitar player, a lead guitar player, bass player, drummer, and myself as the singer. So we're 5-piece.
Okay.
We're a face-painted theatrical band. Think somewhere in between Kiss / Alice Cooper and GWAR, if you're familiar with GWAR. So we're kind of somewhere in the middle of that. A lot of our lyrics are kind of environmental, socio-political commentary, but sort of from a scared straight point of view. So we started off kind of as a death metal band, and as I was searching for lyrical content, I stumbled upon nuclear war and toxic waste, environmental degradation, and that kind of stuff, and started writing these scared straight environmental tunes, you know, save the earth or die with it kind of theme.
Okay.
And we do on stage, we do magic and pyrotechnics and, you know, the climax of the show ever since our first gig has been killing all of the band members by slitting their throats with a giant Bowie knife and leaving them dead and bleeding on the stage, before then killing myself the same way.
Okay.
In this latest reunion though, we added, the theme of our album that unfortunately, because Eric Griswold passed, has been aborted for now, but the album was going to be called Back from the Grave.
Okay.
So that was kind of the theme of our tour. So we added that tune would be our like encore. And when we'd come back from the dead and play as we bled all over the stage,
Okay.
But, you know, this is after bringing a severed head out that bleeds all over the stage. Anyway, so it's a theatrical heavy metal kind of Alice Cooper meets Gwar experience.
Okay.
With a conscience.
So here's when I talk to musicians, I have each type of episode has kind of some questions. So I'm going to switch over to like treating you like a musician now.
Sure. Lay it on me.
As a musician, and these are Washington State based questions.
Okay.
As a musician, what's the coolest venue you performed at? What's the coolest venue you've performed at?
Oh man, the coolest venue I've performed at in Seattle.
Or just in Washington. It can be Seattle, that's fine. But
Boy, there were so many cool ones. Probably the coolest venue, and this is gonna be pretty obscure, but the number one, I'll get to number two because that's gonna be more recognizable. But number one was a place called, I think it was called Lakeview School. It was out by a kind of 180th that was right off the freeway on 180th kind of. They had a big theater there that we rented out, and I put on a show there with R.I.P., headlined over by a band called Rottweiler, which was a pretty big Seattle metal band at one point. It's unsigned, but near the tier of would have been signed, and then opened by a band called Villain, which was in the early 90s, was a popular metal band. It was a huge theater.
Okay.
With a massive stage. So I loved it from the building standpoint. I think the coolest show that we've played probably was that last show in 95. We played at a place called Moe's Moroccan Cafe, which is the building is called Numo's now.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
I don't know how much they've remodeled Numo's because I haven't been in there, I don't think, since it's been Numo's, but it was a really cool place that, you know, was just packed to the gills. We were opening for a local band called the Super Suckers.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I have heard of them.
Yeah. So they're the interesting thing. You know, we were not mega popular, but we were like the band's band. Uh-huh. So bands like the Super Suckers and the Best Kissers in the World and Stickerbush and like the Sleep Capsule, that, you know, a lot of the bands from Seattle that weren't necessarily the grunge acts. We were kind of like their favorite band, or, you know, one of their guilty pleasures, or I don't know how you want to define it, but.
All right. So now we're going to flip that question. Uh-huh. As a fan, uh-huh, where's the coolest venue to see music at that you've been?
Oh man. You know, the big arenas are cool in their way, and they have a great feel, but I would say like, it's gotta be a toss up for me between the Moore Theater and the Paramount Theater. Probably.
Okay.
Those are the kind of places I really like. Big enough to have a big show. In the day, they were dilapidated enough to have a small show, like a relatively small show. Yeah. Nowadays, they've been remodeled and they host pretty big dollar things whenever something goes through there. But I'd say those two are probably my favorite. I've seen some really cool local shows and some really cool national touring acts in both theaters.
Okay.
And I would have loved to play either one. We just never had the opportunity. Well,
that's my third question. Always, okay, where would you aspire to play? So the Paramount are more big answers there. Okay.
I would have loved to play the Kingdom, you know?
No. No. Come on.
Even if we were like, you know.
I mean, from a size standpoint, but from a sonic standpoint
a sound standpoint, those two are both amazing places from an acoustics standpoint.
Yeah, but not the Kingdom.
No.
Yeah, the Kingdom was just.
It was horrible.
It might have been okay today because audio reinforcement's gotten better.
Yep.
But when that building was standing,
I saw the Monsters of Rock tour there, and it wasn't too bad if you were on the floor. But okay. I mean, we're talking 80s technology sound reinforcement. I mean, if Led Zeppelin had played there or something, it would have been awful.
Yeah.
They would have been awesome, but the sound would have been horrible. I saw the Spin Doctor. Do you want to talk about the worst sound ever? I went to a Thunderbirds game back in the arena years ago before it got remodeled.
Uh-huh.
And they pulled the stage out on the ice after the hockey game and the Spin Doctors played. And I was just lucky enough to be sitting in a front row seat. A guy that I knew from work had season tickets long enough that he had a front row behind the home goal. And we were sitting there behind the glass. It was great for the hockey game when the band started playing. It was just bouncy, muddy, nothing. You couldn't tell what song. We had to go up almost to the nosebleed seats to even be able to tell what song they were playing, and it was still horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen some bands in that arena back in the 80s, and it wasn't good.
When it's not full of plexiglass and ice, it's a lot better.
Yeah, but still, even then.
Yeah.
Okay. What's, I guess we'll wrap up with this question. So for the future for Mad Max cars and you guys, what do you think the future looks like? What do you guys want to do? What's next?
What's next? Well, you know, next for us has really been kind of continuing on with the Mad Max stuff, which there's been a huge resurgence because of the Fury Road movie. When that came out in 2015, our phone kind of hasn't stopped ringing since.
Oh, really?
So more of the same as far as the Mad Max cars and the other movie and TV replica cars.
Okay.
Look forward to the day when somebody calls and wants us to build, a replica from Fury Road and has enough money to make it happen, you know, because those are even more intricate builds. But we're really, really expanding the hot rod side of the business, doing hot rods and restoring classic muscle cars and antiques and stuff like that. So I think that the big future for us is continuing to build movie cars more and faster, and really increasing the volume of what we do with regular muscle cars, and continuing to get involved in that part of the hobby.
So I'll put some links in the show notes so they can people, like you mentioned, your YouTube channel, things like that. What didn't I ask you that I should have asked you?
Oh, boy, we've been over so much. I think you covered it pretty well. I mean, I think you covered it pretty well. I don't know what I would add.
Okay.
You know, I could, we've touched on almost everything. I could certainly go into more detail in a lot of things, but I think you covered everything and we got a little brush of the surface of most of the aspects of what we do.
I'm going to ask you, you know, if I can go out into the shop and take a couple of quick shots of a couple of cars. I know they might be clients, but maybe we'll just be able to, maybe for, we haven't talked about, there's one car sitting in the shop right now that is a Batmobile replica. And for someone as old as I am, the Batmobile is kind of a very nostalgic, vehicle. To see that sitting there was kind of like, wow, that's cool.
Absolutely. That's one of my favorites. I guess that figures into the, how did you fall in love with Mad Max? Which I guess is a question I get a lot, but you didn't particularly ask, but the short answer ties in the Batmobile. When I was a kid, I loved the Batman reruns. You know, I was a kid in the 70s mostly. I know I saw a little bit of the 60s, but not enough to remember much. But they were in reruns in the 70s. So Batman, Dukes of Hazzard, Knight Rider, Starsky and Hutch, those kind of things were part of my childhood. And I loved cars from that stuff. So probably if you had asked me then, it would have been a toss up between the Knight Rider car and the General Lee, right?
Right.
But then I saw Mad Max and my whole life changed.
Okay.
So Batmobile, absolutely. That's one of my first loves. That one and the Knight Rider car and the General Lee are all kind of like, you know, loved those cars. So I totally agree. 66 Adam West era Batmobile.
So what's that based on car? What's that car?
So that particular car, what it's built on, is a 1976 Lincoln Mark IV.
Okay.
But all that's left of that car is the floor pan and part of the firewall and the VIN number. The chassis is all custom. The body is completely custom. And, for those of you who, there's a ton of info out here there on that, but just to whet your appetite and if you're a Batmobile fan to get people to start looking into it, it was based on a concept car that Ford built in 1955 called the Lincoln Futura.
Oh.
And if you look up the Lincoln Futura, you'll see a car that looks kind of like the Batmobile, but you can see that DNA in it. George Barris ended up getting that car. It was used in a movie called It Started with a Kiss. And then retired after being on the car show circuit. It was used in one movie and then retired. They sold it to George Barris for $1, even though they probably spent, I think it was like $1.5 million building it. And they sold it for $1 because they were done using it. Most of those kind of cars were crushed and scrapped. But then George Barris got the call shortly after getting the car to build the Batmobile and said, this is a perfect car to modify into the Batmobile. So that's kind of what the car is based on.
That's very cool. All right. Well, thank you for letting me come here today and sit down with you and talk. And this is very cool to me. So I appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing more about you guys.
Awesome. Well, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Join us next time for another episode of the Exploring Washington State Podcast.